listener in the ghaibah. When somebody is backbiting, you say that I'm just not talking, I'm just listening. But being a listener is equally being as if you're doing
exactly.
The ghaibah yourself.
Refer to this fact that both share the same scene, the right. one who is backbiting and the one listening to them.
Right.
So Imam is asking for our ears just to listen to what increases our wisdom.
Yes.
And the last point that I would like to share in this episode is another supplication of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, as mentioned by Kafa Amir rahmatullah alayhi in his Al-Misbah, page 208. There is a famous dua by Imam Mahdi alayhi salam which begins by Allahumma arzuqna tawfiqat ta'a. This is a very famous supplication by Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Yes.
And one of the requests of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is Irfan al-Hurma. Oh Allah, bless me with knowing Hurma. Now there are two definition and interpretation of this part of the dua. One of them is that, oh Allah, bless me with knowing what is forbidden in your religion.
Yes.
And again, a great lesson for all of us as the Shia of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Unfortunately, we see many people who do not know the basics of the religion of Islam when it
right.
comes to halal and haram, the permitted and forbidden actions. So, Irfan al-Hurma, to know the forbidden acts, is what is requested by Imam Mahdi alayhi salam from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the other interpretation is that Irfan al-Hurma means to know what is respected before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So these are two possibilities in defining Irfan al-Hurma.
Right. Thank you so much. I express my gratitude to you, Dr. Murtaza Karimi, for helping us with that. Another enlightening session. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. And until another episode, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Midstream.
Before the celebration of Hezbollah's commemoration of the assassination of the Iranian Quds Force commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, Zionist Israel decided to break the rules of engagement with Lebanon and cross the red line set by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah several months ago. The Israeli occupation carried out an airstrike targeting the deputy head of the political bureau of Hamas, Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri, in the southern suburbs of Beirut. The crime has opened doors to pathways that seem different from the prevailing ones now, politically, militarily, and security-wise, especially since Hezbollah declared in its condolences statement for al-Aruri that the crime will not pass without a response and a punishment. And indeed, it did not. Hezbollah announced the targeting of Maron Air Surveillance Base in northern occupied Palestine on the early morning of Saturday, January 6, by launching 62 rockets. In a statement, the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Hezbollah said that the missile barrage is just the initial response to the assassination of Hamas Political Bureau Deputy Leader Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri in the southern suburb of the Lebanese capital Beirut, who was targeted by Zionist Israel earlier last week on Tuesday, January 2. The missile attack came a day after Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah stated that the resistance must avenge the assassination of Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri. Sayyid Nasrallah warned that if Hezbollah does not retaliate for al-Aruri's assassination in Beirut, all of Lebanon will be vulnerable to Israeli entity attacks. The Maron Air Surveillance Base is located atop Mount Hermon in northern occupied Palestine, being the highest peak in the occupied territories. The base serves as the sole center for administration, surveillance, and air control in the north, with no primary alternative. It is one of the two main bases in the entire Israeli occupation territories, with the other being Mitzpah Ramon to the south. Hezbollah also indicated that this base is responsible for organizing, coordinating, and managing all aerial operations towards Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, Cyprus, and the northern part of the East Mediterranean Basin. It constitutes a central hub for electronic interference operations in the mentioned directions, with significant number of elite Zionist officers and soldiers operating at this base. What distinguishes these intensive rockets launched by Hezbollah is their targeting towards a specific geographical location. This strategy increases the difficulty for the adversary, especially in a defensive context. You see, focusing on a small area makes it challenging to counteract effectively. And all that damage was merely an initial response, as Hezbollah declared. So Zionist Israel now sits and awaits Hezbollah's retaliation against the former crossing the red line of targeting the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, Amara Osman. There is no doubt that the assassination by the Israeli occupation of the second-ranking figure in the Hamas movement, Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri, in the southern suburbs of Beirut, and in addition to being a terrorist attack, is a pivotal point in the course of the war that has been going on for the past 3 months in Gaza, Palestine, and the region as a whole. This act may elevate this war to a new level that is not easily anticipated or precisely defined. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ridwan Murtada, investigative journalist at the Al-Akhbar, the Cradle, and Al-Mahatta. It's a pleasure having you, Mr. Murtada, with us now. How was Zionist Israel capable of assassinating the deputy head of Hamas, the second in ranking in the political bureau of Hamas, Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri, in the most secure area in the southern suburbs of the capital, Beirut?
The security war between the Israeli occupation entity and the Islamic resistance in Lebanon is ongoing. The assassination of Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri marked a blatant violation of red lines, unlike previous incidents since 2006. The equation of deterrence remained clear until Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri's assassination, with only two prior breaches by the Israeli entity. The recent assassination differs significantly from previous cases, indicating a new front with Lebanon. Israel utilized its intelligence capabilities, technological advancements, and a vast network of agents to breach Lebanon's security. Since 2019, Lebanese security forces have uncovered around 300 agents recruited by Israeli intelligence, exploiting Lebanon's economic crisis. Israel posed as hiring companies, gathering CVs, and recruiting individuals to surveil Beirut's southern suburbs, capturing key locations. This information, combined with technological advancements like mobile phone monitoring, enabled the Israeli occupation to carry out the assassination in Beirut's southern suburbs.
مع العلم انه الشيخ صالح كان محطوط على لوائح الاغتيالات الاسرائيليه وتعرض لتهديد مباشر قبل.
Despite having the ability to destroy the entire building, Zionist Israel executed a targeted operation using 6 missiles, killing Sheikh Saleh and two leaders of the Qassam brigades along with others. Netanyahu's advisor immediately stated the operation targeted Hamas, not Hezbollah or the Lebanese state, as Israel just executed its prior threats. Sheikh Saleh had been on the Israeli entity's assassination list, taking security measures, but the recent attack violated all red lines, escalating the confrontation. Hezbollah responded immediately by launching 62 rockets at the Zionist Intelligence Center in Meron base, prompting a fierce Israeli occupation retaliation. This sets the stage for a different type of confrontation with developments unfolding in the coming days.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual assassination was not via a drone, as it was said. It was via six missiles. These six missiles were dropped how? From an F-16, for example? What is the weapon and how was it dropped?
This type of missile is a laser-guided smart missile, allowing the Israeli entity remote control up to 100 kilometers. Lebanese investigators gathered data and forensic evidence at the targeted location, which revealed that six missiles were directed at Sheikh Al-Arouri's office. Four missiles exploded, while two did not. One missile penetrated all the ceilings, reaching an underground parking space, and was confiscated by the Lebanese army, and the second was confiscated by the resistance for analysis. These missiles can reach and penetrate the designated target, meaning the Israeli entity can guide them to the intended destination before detonation. Unlike typical missiles, they don't explode upon surface contact, but penetrate multiple layers, including reinforced concrete, before exploding at the predetermined location, known to the Israeli entity intel with prior information about Al-Arouri's location.
Well, I wanted to talk more about how the retaliation of the resistance was in Lebanon, but sadly on Monday afternoon we heard news coming out from South Lebanon that another assassination happened in Khirbet Silem, a village in South Lebanon, targeting supposedly a very high-ranking official in the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah. What information do you have about that?
The information available about the assassination operation carried out by the Israeli entity's air force targeting a car of a resistance leader indicated that Damara is a prominent figure in the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, known as Haj Wissam al-Tawil, also known as Haj Jawad. He held responsibilities within various centers, initially serving as a commander inside Syria, leading infantry operations for the resistance. Later, he assumed command of military operations in the southern region of Lebanon within the unit overseeing these activities. Haj Jawad led field military operations related to attacks against Israeli occupation centers. His movements were monitored and he was targeted in a calculated manner. He's not the first resistance leader to be targeted, as Israeli entity sources initially reported the assassination of a highly important and unusual figure in southern Lebanon, later revealed to be Haj Jawad, born in 1975. He played a crucial role in military operations targeting Israeli occupation forces since the beginning of the Israeli occupation war on Lebanon during Tufan al-Aqsa on October 7. He held a high position overseeing these operations and has now been targeted by Zionist Israel.
You think in less than a minute, do you think this is an escalation by the Zionist entity that might lead to further violence on the border between Lebanon and Palestine?
The escalation on the southern front between the resistance in Lebanon and the Israeli occupation is evident and clear. If you observe the trajectory of the war in the south, you can see that the escalation is significant and apparent. This indicates that Zionist Israel is uneasy in Gaza and is searching for targets outside Gaza and victories it can achieve. The escalation began effectively with the assassination of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps leader, Mr. Radi al-Musawi, in Damascus on December 25, followed by the assassination of Sheikh Saleh al-Arouri and subsequent bombings of civilian homes in southern Lebanon. The nature of the bombardment following the assassinations differs from the initial events, extending to the targeting of Hezbollah field commanders and the destruction of their homes, not just limited to a specific geographical area. Over the past few days, the targeting of a house in the town of Kautarita Siyad and the town of Jibshit shows that the scope of the war with the Israeli occupation is expanding, and the types of missiles and weapons used by the occupation are broadening, signaling the beginning of an assassination war.
Well, it seems that this is going to be a very, very interesting week between Lebanon and occupied Palestinian territories. I want to thank you very much from Beirut, Mr. Radwan Murtada, investigative journalist at Al-Akhbar, The Cradle and Al-Mahatta, for your kind contribution to our show. Thank you very much. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the Israeli threats and, to be frank, the folly of an Israeli charade in South Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In the Gaza Strip, without officially announcing it, the Israeli occupation army has effectively entered the third stage of the conflict, which involves a gradual reduction in the size of forces and a focus on active arenas. As for Lebanon, the circumstances are complex to no less extent, and they may worsen. Not because Hezbollah and Hamas will seek revenge for the death and martyrdom of Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri, but because Zionist Israel finds itself in a delicate situation that might push it towards a broader military operation if political efforts do not mature. More details in this following report.
It seems that the U.S. envoy Amos Hochstein, who very recently visited Tel Aviv, is hesitant to come to Lebanon unless he has a clear vision that can convince the Lebanese. Hochstein understands that his presence would be futile in light of the functional collaboration between the United States of America and the Zionist entity, whose army failed to achieve any of the goals of the genocidal war against the Palestinian people and thus eliminate the Palestinian cause. In the meantime, observers were able to trace back the new confusion in the U.S. administration to the fundamental speech of Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah on the anniversary of the assassination of the revolutionary leaders, martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. This speech clearly stated, "If Zionist Israel wages war on Lebanon, then our fight will be limitless, boundless, ruleless, and unstrained." Amos Hochstein, the envoy of the U.S. president, failed in his Tel Aviv trip to push forward a political agreement to end the fighting in the north. The U.S. Secretary of State will try again soon, too. However, the source of the crisis in the north lies in the initial stage of the war that occurred following Al-Aqsa flood operation. After Hezbollah started launching rockets and anti-tank shells, Zionist Israel decided to evacuate residents from settlements located within a distance of 3.5 kilometers from the border. Israeli occupation soldiers entered the settlements instead of the illegal colonial settlers, and since then, Hezbollah has been firing at them daily, causing a significant number of casualties. The directives from the Home Front Command regarding the evacuation also included the settlement of Kiryat Shmona, where more than 60,000 people have left their homes, some from more distant settlements without state instructions. The Zionist regime leadership had pledged in an earlier stage to work towards changing the situation, possibly committing themselves without ruling out a military operation. The current exchange of fire may continue for several months, during which American-French efforts will aim to reach a political agreement. However, the likelihood of success is low, so there is a possibility that Zionist Israel will also prepare for a military operation after the resumption of diplomatic communications. This is even before considering the possibility that a strong Hezbollah response to the assassination of Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri will lead to real escalation afterward. In addition to the promise of avenging the assassination and the targeting of Beirut, there is also Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's conditional warning. If Zionist Israel launches a comprehensive war, Hezbollah will remove all constraints. That sends shivers down the spine of Zionist warmongering leaders.
Now, to discuss this very important issue with us from South Lebanon is Brigadier General Dr. Amin Hutait, University Instructor and Researcher after his retirement from service with the Lebanese Army. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Amin Hutait. Now, Hezbollah sent 62 missiles to one of the largest Zionist military bases in northern occupied Palestine, which is the Meron Air Surveillance Base, as a primary retaliation for the assassination of Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri last week in Beirut. What makes this intensive rocket retaliation and that specific geographic situation or geographic location so very important and unique this time?
The Islamic resistance in Lebanon used its missiles on a target chosen with adherents to control the regulated rules of war. Regarding the missiles themselves, the resistance opted for a diversified composition to ensure precision in hitting the target. Therefore,
Guided missiles were included to evade the Zionist Iron Dome. The resistance intensified the number of missiles to 62, believing that the Iron Dome intercepting approximately 35% of the missiles should allow the remaining 40 missiles to reach the target. However, the Iron Dome failed to intercept the missiles. As for the third aspect, the resistance chose missiles with destructive capabilities to ensure reaching the target and causing the desired damage, achieving success in this regard. Concerning the target itself, the resistance selected a strategically complex target with specific implications. Its functions extends beyond the field it is in, reaching from northern occupied Palestine to the entire region of West Asia, including Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and stretching to Turkey and the northeastern Mediterranean. Therefore, this target is considered one of the strategic objectives distinct from the operational objectives that occupied the resistance for the past 3 months. Hence, the choice of the target and its handling is considered creative and well executed.
Dr. Ahtayt, Hezbollah still has, according to his claims, a secondary retaliatory attack aimed at Zionist Israel after the enemy broke one of the deterrent equations by targeting the Lebanese capital, Beirut, while assassinating Sheikh Arouri. In your expert opinion as a military man, what would such a retaliation look like, and when would it be done? And do you think that Zionist Israel will just bite the bullet and take that hit, or will it retaliate?
In the first point, Hezbollah carried out the action and termed it as an initial response. The initial response will be followed by gathering data and information, then assessing the situation. If Hezbollah determines that the action served its purpose, it will suffice with what it has done. Otherwise, it will choose another target to pursue its goals, aiming to restore the deterrence equation, punish the Israeli enemy, and avenge the blood of martyrs. Therefore, the matter hinges on the assessment of the situation. As for the results and the possibility of heading towards war, if the decision were solely in the hands of Netanyahu, considering the current reality, we might say that war would break out tomorrow, because Netanyahu's interest lies in going to war and involving the United States. However, the decision for war is not individual and exclusive for the Zionists. Moreover, it is not solely a Zionist-Israeli one. It is a decision made by Zionist Israel and can be endorsed or annulled by the United States. In our current reality, we see that the Meron base operation has postponed the war and not hastened it. Any drumming for war now is merely psychological warfare to extract a price in return.
Well, Dr. Hatet, I know we're talking about Lebanon and the Lebanese front, but one of the most important escalatory situations that happened in West Asia was the front line in Iraq as well, not only in Lebanon, by attacking the U.S. occupation forces both in Iraq and Syria. And it seems that the scene in Iraq is just gaining momentum, just as the scene in Lebanon as well. How do you think that will translate on the ground with the U.S. occupation forces, just as Israel is sending also its Secretary of State to try and find some sort of a solution in Gaza at the same time?
The dynamics unfolding in the Iraqi front are associated with two factors. The first factor is its distance from the main front established in Gaza and its lack of direct connection to Palestinian territory. The second and more crucial matter is this front's relationship with its objectives, which is to exert pressure on the Americans. The United States is diligently working to media block this front because its activation is not in America's interest, especially since this front seriously addresses the issue of the U.S. occupation in Syria and Iraq. Mobilizing this front would energize the liberation process in these regions. Currently in Iraq, there is official and popular movement calling for an end to the international coalition's presence in Iraq and the withdrawal of their forces in any capacity or under any pretext. This disturbs the U.S. and challenges many cards it tried to retain, especially after inventing ISIS, Daesh, and bringing it to Iraq as a bridge for its return. Therefore, we see that the U.S. is trying on one hand to prevent the expansion of the war to avoid stirring attention to its occupying presence, and on the other hand, to conceal operations targeting it to avoid discussing this presence. However, I believe that the U.S.'s hand has been overtaken, and now the issue of the American occupation in Syria and Iraq is being seriously addressed and will continue to be raised until a comprehensive solution is found through liberation.
We can end off with Beirut again, with Lebanon and the situation in less than a minute, if you can, please. Do you think that this de-escalation might happen with the efforts right now by the U.S. to try to de-escalate because of their own situation and their own quagmire, but Zionist Israel is still assassinating leaders in South Lebanon, just as happened on Monday afternoon? Do you think that there is a room for de-escalation?
I believe that the main war initiated by Zionist Israel against the Gaza Strip, which attracted supporting fronts, has reached its final stage. It has now turned into a war of attrition initiated by Zionist Israel with U.S. support and embraced to buy time to find political solutions. I think we are facing 2 to 3 weeks in the path of searching for political solutions. The widespread explosion, decisive war, control and subjugation have all become things of the past. And Zionist Israel has suffered 2 defeats. The original defeat in the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood operation and the recent defeat in the Gaza Strip. The United States failed to hold the winning cards, but it is now attempting to compensate for this failure by trying to regain control of the situation. However, I believe that ultimately Zionist Israel will yield to the American decision and cease the war.
Well, Brigadier General Dr. Amin Hatayt, University Instructor and Researcher and retired Army General from the services of the Lebanese Army, thank you very much for your kind contribution to our show and your explanation of what the Zionist Israeli enemy is trying to do and not will be able, capable to actually perform on the front between Lebanon and occupied Palestine. Thank you very much for being with us, ladies and gents. Thank you. Please do follow us next week for more updates from right here in West Asia on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
The frequency of gun violence in the United States has prompted authorities to refer to it as an epidemic. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Sputnik news agency has covered this story and tells us more. A reporter said gun violence in the United States has taken the lives of more than 42,300 people in 2023, emphasizing that Americans use guns mostly to commit suicide, followed by homicide, self-defense, and unintentional shootings. The figures published by the nonprofit organization Gun Violence Archive on Tuesday, 26th of December, it also said There have been 18,541 cases of other gun-related deaths, of which more than 650 incidents were related to mass shootings, while others involved 40 mass murders, 1,161 defensive use cases, and 1,543 unintentional shootings. 23,760 suicide cases were also registered in the United States. It said more than 1,600 children between the ages of 0 and 17 were killed in gun violence incidents, and 4,444 others were injured. Furthermore, the report noted that 46 law enforcement officers were killed in gun violence incidents, and 1,412 suspects were killed in officer-involved cases. The watchdog tracks gun violence incidents using law enforcement, media, governmental, and commercial sources. In the meantime, the frequency of gun violence in the United States has prompted authorities to refer to it as a national epidemic. There have been more than 600 mass shootings, averaging almost two a day, in the United States since 2019. Democratic U.S. President Joe Biden has called on Congress to address the issue, urging lawmakers to ban assault weapons. However, Republicans are staunch promoters of U.S. gun culture and adamantly adhere to the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the right to bear arms, opposing strict bans on guns. A Gallup opinion poll from October of 2022 showed that the majority of Americans are in favor of gun control, saying they want stricter laws for the sale of firearms. There are an estimated 393 million civilian-owned firearms in the United States. Approximately one-third of the adult population in the United States, which equates to 82,880,000 people, own at least one firearm. The website of NBC News has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a new opinion poll published recently, gun ownership has reached a record high among American voters. More than half of respondents, or 52%, reported that they are or someone in their household owned a gun. That percentage is the highest since NBC began asking that question in 1999. The opinion poll suggests gun ownership rates have risen sharply over the past decade, with just 42% of those surveyed in 2013 claiming they or another household member possessed a firearm. That number was up to 49% by 2019. Republicans are significantly more likely than Democrats or independents to own guns, with two-thirds of Republican voters reporting a gun in the household compared to just 41% of Democrats and 45% of independents. Still, the percentage of Democrats who said they or a family member had a firearm increased 11 percentage points over the last decade. Black voters have been the biggest increase in gun ownership since the opinion poll was last conducted in 2019, from 24% up to 41%, while the increase among white voters was minimal, from 53% to 56%. Attitudes were split about gun control, with 47% stating that they believe the government would go too far in restricting Americans' Second Amendment right to bear arms, while 48% said they feared the government would do little to regulate firearms. With personal safety topping the list of reasons Americans give for owning a gun, surging violent crime rates across the nation are believed to have contributed to the increase in firearm ownership. A 2021 Gallup opinion poll found 88% of respondents said they owned a gun for protection against crime, a significant increase over the 67% who answered similarly when the question was asked back in 2005. According to Swiss research project, the Small Arms Survey, the United States has the highest rate of gun ownership in the world and is the only nation known to have more guns than people. It also has the highest rate of gun homicides. Gun control advocates argue for a cause-and-effect relationship between the two statistics. However, the gun homicide rate in Washington, D.C. is the highest in the United States, and cities like Chicago regularly see over a dozen gun deaths per week, despite strict gun control laws in both cities. The issue continues to polarize the nation as President Joe Biden continues to campaign for a ban on assault weapons, even though a study by the RAND Corporation found no evidence that such a ban would reduce gun violence or homicide rates in the United States. The Hill newspaper has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to an opinion poll, a greater share of Americans say gun violence is a major problem compared to 5 years ago, with the sentiment increasing across the political spectrum. An opinion poll from the Pew Research Center recently found that 60% of Americans' respondents said gun violence is a very big problem in the U.S., while 23% said it is a moderately big problem. More than 60% also said they expect the level of gun violence to get worse in the next 5 years, while about 30% said it will stay the same, and only 7% said it will drop. Democrats are much more likely than Republicans to consider gun violence a very big problem, with 81% of Democrats and 38% of Republicans surveyed in the opinion poll saying so. But the share of respondents who expressed that sentiment is up 9 percentage points for each group since 2018. The overall percentage of Americans surveyed who said they consider gun violence a major problem rose 7 percentage points from 53% in 2018. Pollsters also found a slight increase in the percentage of Americans who said they support stricter gun laws, which rose 5 percentage points from 2021 to 58% now. That figure is about in line with the 60% who said so back in 2019. Only 15% said gun laws should be less strict, about the same as the opinion poll has found in recent years.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
This edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini. The son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Awad, hosting this program, and Shoaib Javid, our guest speaker. The topic we are dealing with in the previous episodes and this one, and hopefully in the future, is some of the jurisprudential laws related to homes based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, somebody asked, the banks have a method for depositing money which makes it inaccessible to the depositor. It's in fact kept in one's bank account with a particular method of computation. Is Khums applicable to that money?
Well, it depends on whether he is able to withdraw the money or not.
Mm-hmm.
If the bank does not give him access to his account and he is not able to withdraw the money, he's not supposed to pay any Khums. But if he, as we see in, for example, in Iran, we deposit money and we are able to withdraw money every day or every month, no matter, it's all up to us. So if we are able to withdraw money, khums should be paid at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm, I see. Is khums, Sheikh Javid, obligatory for the house tenant or the landlord on the money that the tenant deposits with the landlord?
Again, I should say that we discussed this and elaborated on this issue in the very first episode. If the money is from the annual earnings of the tenant, then it is, you know, khums is obligatory for the tenant after the landlord returns it. Unless, of course, he is unable to pay the full rent of the lessor or does not, you know, or maybe the landlord does not accept a lesser amount. Of course, in this case, he does not have to pay khums. And also, if he's not able to, I'm speaking about the tenant. If the tenant is not able to rent a proper house, a suitable one, and in the event that he pays khums to the khums, he will be incapacitated in one way or the other. So again, he is not going to pay khums on the money that he pays to the landlord in order for him to get his house and to live in the house of the landlord.
Mm-hmm. Sheikh Javid, it happens to some workers or some employees, unfortunately, in the world, that some of the factory owners or company and incorporations, employers don't pay their employees. And for several years, sometimes or several months, it happens that they do not pay their workers or employees their own salaries. Will it be considered as income of the khums year in which they receive it so that they should calculate its khums at the end of that year? Or is it not subject to khums at all?
Well, this money, which is paid later, maybe many months later, would be considered as part of the annual income of the year of receipt. I mean the year in which the employee received the money. And it is, of course, and it khums should be paid on the excess of this money. For example, you earn money and you get the money from your employer, and then the money is in excess of your need because it's a huge amount of money paid to you after many months, after several months. So the money is over and above your needs. So khums should be paid on the very day in which you are supposed to pay khums.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, Anshar Chavid, our guest speaker. We're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws concerning khums based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Chavid, someone has a personal library whose books he used for a while. For several years, he has not used them, but it's likely that he may use them in the future. Does khums apply to the library in the period that he does not use the books? Is there any difference in respect of liability to khums, whether the original purchaser of the books was he himself or his father or anybody else?
Good. Well, if at the time of purchase he was indeed in need of reading those books and using those books as reference, and they are books that he actually that was suitable for him. For example, if there is a great scholar, he needs to have many books in his house to have access to them, even though he may not be using them for many years, but he was in need of the whole volumes because there are more many volumes of the same book. So he was in need of those books. He purchased them. He does not have to pay khums on those books. But if someone buys books that are not, that he is not supposed to have, like he buys books and use them for simply decoration, puts them on the shelves so as to make an impression that he is a man of knowledge, he is a man of reading and books and so on and so forth. Obviously, in such a case, khums should be paid by him because he did not need those books for reading and researching. Now, when it comes to buying, purchasing books with money that was gifted by, let's say, by your father, as you said, or by someone else, your friend, based on the principle or on the doctrine of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, there is no khums paid on gifted amount, there is no khums payable on gifted property or whatever comes from someone else as a gift.
Even if they don't mention it's a gift, but they still give it.
Yeah, they give it because you did not do any work for that person. He gave it to you as a gift. Khums is not paid on that thing. And of course, even if many years run over that thing, let's say it's a library, it's a few books, volumes of books. So many years pass over the books. You do not have to pay khums on those books.
Sheikh Sobid, you and I are part of this cultural community that we normally study and research.
Of course.
Right?
Yes.
And normally people who research have their personal library.
They do.
The size doesn't really matter. I mean, we are not talking about like big your huge library. Yeah. We are talking about personal use libraries.
Of course.
All right? Like our bookshelf, for example. And in our bookcase, there are a couple of books that we don't use, let's say, on an annual basis, right?
Yes.
Like there are some books that we use daily, and there are some books that we use maybe once in a month.
Yes.
And there are some books that we don't really use like in a year. Sometimes we refer to those books.
Yes.
Such as reference books,
you're
right?
Right.
All right. What about these books? Are these books liable to khums?
I think the same answer applies to this scenario you mentioned.
Mm.
Because you are a researcher, and it's very much within your status as a researcher to have books, even though you do not need them. So you potentially need them maybe in the future,
mm-hmm.
And at any time.
Exactly.
It may happen to you that you might want to use that book. So basically you bought them to address your needs, to resolve your needs.
Mm-hmm.
So khums is not paid on them, as the answer goes in the book written by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, Ajbibatul Istifta'at.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Sobid. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran, Republic of Iran, on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.